Campbell, Chair of the State Board of Podiatry Examiners, December 14, 2022. We're calling our meeting to order. As far as roll call, I believe everyone is present, correct, Heather?
That is correct.
Okay. Does anyone have any conflict of interest in, to declaring any of the agenda items? Okay. Hearing none, we're going to go ahead and move to number six, which is discussion, consideration, possible action regarding the topic of legislation proposed by the Arizona Foot and Ankle Medical Association and the State Association lobbyist. Mr. Joe Abadi is present, so he's going to give us an update.
Yes, for the record, my name is Joe Abadi. I'm the attorney lobbyist for the Arizona Foot and Ankle Medical Association. And going a little bit of background, we all realized by the late session last year, actually the board's attorney and executive director found a statute, and I concurred that it would give us some problems in being able to, having the board by rule, do what we thought we had accomplished the year or so before in giving the board the power to set rules for medical assistance and under the supervision of a podiatrist. And we met with the Department of Health Services late May of this year, actually, and we're still in 2022. And we discussed various solutions, and we all agreed that the solution and the Department of Health Services agreed would support coming in next year with a statutory provision to amend one of the sections dealing with certificates for X-ray technicians by the Department of Health Services, and having amending that particular statute exempt the podiatry medical assistance regulated by the podiatry board, licensing board, from the purviews of that particular statute, which was stated to 2811. And so it was a simple fix. We, after we found out who the health chairman was in the Senate, Senator T.J. Shope, who's a really good guy and someone has been on health committee before and someone I knew personally well over the years. We had an appointment, we met with him, Heather and I and Mary Peters from the association. Three of us met with T.J. Shope, Senator Shope, and we discussed our situation and legislation that would fix our concerns and allow the board to do what we wanted to do and should be able to do and qualified to be able to do. And he then agreed. It was a short meeting. I've been working with the Rick Hazelton from the legislative liaison for the Department of Health Services, who used to work at the legislature as a staffer for years, and kept him informed after the meeting. And T.J. Shope wanted us to go over to Ledge Council to open a file so we can start the process to have a bill introduced this upcoming session. And we did that and gave our suggested language, and which followed other exemptions in that same statute, as far as the wording goes. And then we got the draft back last week, and so we were fine with it, and talking to Heather and talking to Rick Hazelton, he did talk to his superiors, and they were fine with it. And so I notified Senator Shope's staff that please, we're fine with the draft, and please introduce, get an interest set, established and set up, and so it could be introduced. Now, Senator Shope said either he would introduce it, or his new vice chairman would be one that would be introducing it. Some of the more simpler bills, she's the neat person in the legislature, and I've met her, and she's a very fine person, and she's from the Buckeye area, Janaya Stamp is her name, Senator Stamp. Stamp.
Oh, okay.
S-T-A-M-P. Janaya is J-A-N-A-I-E or something. It was not an usual first name, but anyway, so that's where we're at. And I've checked with the association, everyone seems to be on board there, and the executive committee, and so we're off and running at this point, and we've done all we can do at this point, we'll keep you. I know Heather and I will keep you all posted as we go through the process. Let's face it, nothing's ever easy in the legislative process, but hopefully we don't see any organized opposition to this, and so that's a big help. That's a step in the right direction, and we'll go from there, and we'll keep you posted, and we'll certainly do our utmost, our best to get this thing passed, because it's important, I think, to the profession and to you all to do your job properly, that we see this thing pass. So there we are. So any questions or?
Thank you, Mr. Abad. So I know all the my board members have read the language, and Dr. Ilana, do you have any response to the language in favor or not in favor?
I'm in favor of it, since the legislation.
Okay. Okay, so since we are formally supporting the wording for the legislation, I will go ahead and make a motion to direct Heather to post that support of the language on our website.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, board members, if I may, it would be putting in a thumbs up of support on the legislature.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, that's
just
correct.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So it's been moved and seconded. Any other discussion or comments? All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
So moved. Thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Abadi.
Thank you all. I appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. Okay, now we're going to go back to our investigation files, and that is under 5A. Our first complaint is 22-02-3, Dr. Seth Clark, and this is a continuation from August 10th, 2022 meeting, and our investigator is Dr. Saunders, so I'll have Dr. Saunders, if you want to come up, and we'll hear your investigating report. And we do not have a complainant on the line, but
did we do the declaration of conflicts?
Yes, we did.
Okay, sorry.
Yes, we did that.
So I actually don't remember. Did we formally go through this yet?
No.
As a report?
We did.
Tabled afterwards? Or?
Yeah, because we wanted more information. We were requesting more information, so, yeah. But just as a summarize, or if you...
Cases getting blurred, patients in my office, and this, it's confused for me, so I don't remember where we stand with it. I'll just do a quick little summary again, and then we kind of pick up as to what we still need and go from there. Patient BR formed the initial complaint regarding being misdiagnosed. And treatment that was performed.
22-02-C. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Dr. Clark's case. Thank you.
Sorry about that. Case BR against Dr. Clark. I'm Dr. Saunders. Problem consisted of being misdiagnosed and treated, and then there was also a big concern regarding release of medical records, taking several months to obtain them. I won't go into as much of a detail then, I guess, as I did before. Discussion regarding this and going through medical records, I guess I'm going to just highlight some of my concerns rather than go through the whole case again. If the board wants me to be more detailed, we can. But this was a patient back in 2020. A patient was seen initially for some bilateral heel pain, and there were some concerns regarding plantar fasciitis. And Dr. Clark came up with the diagnosis of a stress fracture as well, tarsal tunnel plantar fasciitis. A patient did go through a course for conservative therapies. I had some concerns whether or not it was treated appropriately if indeed the patient had a stress fracture. The patient had different types of anti-inflammatories. Conservative therapies were done. The patient received an MRI. This is preoperatively as ordered, I think, by family practice at this point. And then there was, from a clinical perspective, concerns regarding whether this patient indeed had a stress fracture or not. Dr. Clark believed that the patient had some bone marrow edema. When I looked at the radiographs, I did not appreciate it, nor a stress fracture, and the radiologist did not report on that. And that strikes some of the concern that was found regarding some of the treatment. As Dr. Clark was treating this patient as if he had a stress fracture. I made note in the charts that the patient was not immobilized preoperatively, as I would have done, I think standard of care would have done, if indeed stress fracture. This patient subsequently, after receiving some injections and conservative therapies, went on to a surgical procedure, two of them, as a matter of fact, by Dr. Clark. The first initial surgery was performed, I'll go through the procedures, was an endoscopic gastrocnemiosecond, an endoscopic tarsal tunnel, endoscopic plantar fasciotomy, a Z-plasty incision, and then treatment of the calcaneal fracture with injection of calcium phosphate. We go through the different procedures and what they were chosen for. The biggest concern here was the treatment of a stress fracture, calcaneal fracture, and whether or not it did indeed exist or not. Going through some of the notes subsequently, post-operative care was normal. Patients ended up a few weeks after that surgery, ended up getting cortisone injections to the fascia and the tarsal tunnel post-operatively. Patient at that time still was not getting a relief after the conservative therapy and the surgery, and underwent a series, I think, 7 or 8 amniotic injections to the plantar fascia, to the calcaneal stress area. This was done over a course of 2 weeks apart, these amniotic injections, done both, I think, I'd have to look back, but mostly in pain centers. Subsequently, following that, patient had some nerve density testings done, as the patient still was not responding properly. And then patient went back to a second surgery, where an injection of this calcium phosphate was then placed back into the heel tube at an outpatient center. Going to my conclusions, we discussed this at previous cases where I find it difficult to follow the EMR charting and notes. Significant cutting and pasting is done, which is fine, but no new relevant information is added to each visit. In some of the notes, the cut and paste templates of the preoperative discussion was still in the postoperative discussion. For instance, talking about a tarsal tunnel, EMG studies, and MRI preoperatively. These are still in the notes for the patient after the patient had surgery and had MRIs done. So it's just difficult to follow what's new, what's been done, and what's going on. Going back to my summary, I do believe that the patient had some conservative therapy for plantar fasciitis, for tarsal tunnel. It's a question of whether or not this patient indeed had a stress fracture versus bone marrow edema versus trabecular insufficiency. I think it's not documented well in there, and you know, it's not seen on the radiographs. And in Dr. Clark's notes for these injections, it's not documented well in there. There was a little back and forth after the case was reported that Dr. Clark said, you know, immobilization wasn't done because the patient initially refused a CAMBOOT in the conservative therapies, and it's just not documented there. I don't see it. And if it is, it's just because I can't find it in the notes. But you know, I couldn't appreciate that at all. Postoperatively, the patient was in a CAMBOOT for 2 weeks. Ambulatory. I normally would keep patients non-ambulatory after a tarsal tunnel surgery, after the Z-plasty incisions. But CAMBOOT, I think, was acceptable at that point. It was for a short period of time, not necessarily long enough for a stress fracture. I think most of us, for a stress fracture, standard of care would be 6 weeks of partial mobilization. Now that two-week course, and it's just not well documented that the patient refused it for that much. There was questions regarding whether or not the right procedures were done by another physician when the patient got a second opinion, whether procedures were done or not. A second MRI was performed. It does document that the fasciotomy was done. You know, it's hard to comment as to what was done intraoperatively, but it does appear that the doctor did what he said he did. Again, the injections of the calcium phosphate into a bone that did not necessarily have a fracture is the confusing part for me. In the operative report, he also mentions manipulation. Indeed, fracture. What are we manipulating as far as the bone to get it back into positioning? The operative note also mentioned that there was no fracture seen when he made the small incision over there. I have some concerns as to why we're doing all these endoscopic procedures and then doing an open Z-plasty. It seems contradicting to me. If you're making a big incision for the Z-plasty, you might as well just have a full visual release. I'm not saying that's wrong. It's just, it doesn't make a lot of sense from a surgeon point of view for me. I had some concerns regarding all of these amnio injections. Patient had one preoperatively to try to see if this would help, but we didn't really wait long enough to see if it did help. Patient, you know, we waited 5 or 6 days and then went to surgery. It wasn't delayed to see if the amnio injection did indeed help. Then we had, you know, 7 more, I believe, after the surgery when he wasn't responding. Again, not really allowing a lot of time to see if the amnio injection would work. Find that, you know, it'd be more useful to do 1 or 2 injections and then give it a month or so to see if it helped rather than doing 7 or 8. I feel like it's a little overutilization. The literature normally reports also just kind of giving some more time for that. We talked a little bit about the financials at one point regarding this. I think this has been covered in other cases that the doctor has a lab. He did bill for a pathology lab. He did bill for the pathology codes for the nerve density and the now pathologies. I believe that's to be appropriate for the stains and images that they were doing for that procedure. And all, you know, that's my review for this. We talked a little bit as well about this patient was being obese and whether or not he needed some medical clearances beforehand, preoperative assessment. I think that was addressed already at this point that the patient was appropriately done at ASC. Questions or comments I can do regarding this case forward?
Yes, I have a couple questions about this. There was a 99214 that was billed in the post-operative period where there was discussion about the contralateral limb procedure.
Yes.
What's your opinion of that during a global period? If you've already done the same surgery on one side, is that appropriate to bill for that code again for discussion on the contralateral limb?
Yeah, I would consider that a gray area. I think it can be acceptable when you are, you know, when you're in the post-op recovery for one procedure and then you're going to talk about another procedure. Sometimes things have changed and it would be worthwhile to discuss with a patient. You know, maybe this didn't work out so well on the left foot, so I'm going to do something slightly different on the right foot, or this is going to be a different post-operative course, and that needs to be discussed. You know, it is a separate procedure. Whether or not you're going to bill for it is, I guess, ethically up to the physician themselves. doctor did include, you know, some of the physical examinations to upgrade it to a 99214. You know, I don't think it's something I would do. I think that gets covered in the initial pre-op. This was our plan. Nothing did seem to change in the plan. The patient never went through with it, as he never got satisfactory results and moved on to another physician. Ethically, I don't think I'd do it, but I think it's acceptable.
And I certainly agree that standard of care on stress fractures, you know, doctor is indicating that he feels there's a stress fracture present, so why wasn't it immobilized for that period of maybe 6 to 8 weeks? The other on the amount of amnion ejections given, you're right, you know, most of the protocol and the literature out there indicates in some of the studies, there's one that was done by Spector, and then there's another by, it indicated, you know, in these studies that, well, the Spector one, within a 45-day period, they had noticed the, you know, in that waiting time, they analyzed people at certain months to see what their reduction in their pain was. And they waited. And, you know, waited, they were, you know, some only received one injection in a 45-day period. And they noticed that at the end of that 45-day period, you know, the pain was greatly reduced and there was no secondary, you know, injections given. They also, you know, people are also immobilized after those amnio injections because you're trying to give it time to heal. And no cortisone injections and no non-steroidal anti-inflammatories because you'd be negating everything you're trying to do with the amnion because of the chemotaxis of the cells to get into that area to heal that blocks the prostaglandins and everything. Yeah. So that affects that. So
I agree.
If, you know, that would be, you know, contraindication there. So because the two steroid injections were obviously before, but I'm looking in the chart and they're, you know, were there, you know, other anti-inflammatories that the patient was on as per the rheumatologist. So that has gout, there was allopurinol.
Right, yeah, the patient was on an anti-inflammatory
right,
times.
Okay, to make sure that was not inappropriate treatment.
Yeah, I think the key really is, you know, you do one or two of these and then you give it some time to see how it heals. You know, the difference is sometimes when we're treating wounds with this, then you can sometimes do it a weekly apart, and that's
the
approval. You know, we also got some literature back, and I'll let Dr. Clark discuss this if he chooses to. But, you know, we were concerned about, or I was concerned about the injections of the calcium phosphate into this calcaneus, whether or not it even had a stress fracture or not. There's not a known defect in there where we're doing like an OCD lesion or there's a bone tumor that you're injecting. All that is reasonable for the bone marrow insufficiencies. Dr. Clark forwarded an article to the board by a case study by Dr. Nigg. You know, forgive me if I'm pronouncing his name wrong, regarding recalcitrant plantar fasciitis where he injected that. And, I was unfamiliar with that particular study. I read through the article, and it actually, unfortunately, I don't think it helps support his case. This was a revision case, not an initial treatment case. This was a secondary procedure 6 months after the patient had first surgery. The patient had clinical documentation on the radio, on the MRI, of a bone marrow insufficiency, and then the patient was injected with that type of calcium substrates. Also, this patient was immobilized for 3 weeks after the procedure, going into that. You know, non-wavering for 3 weeks and then in the CAM boot for, I believe, 2 months after that. So, and it was an independent case study. I don't think that this is a standard practice that we're using.
Any questions for Doctor?
I mean, I do use a calcium phosphate for stress, but I keep them in the boot a lot longer, pre and post. So I do use it for...
Sure, but, you know, is there a radiographic evidence of such?
On the MRI, yes.
It has to be something, I think, yeah. I think that's reasonable treatment if there's a defect on there. Do you use it primary option?
No, well, first conservative therapy, and then I would use the calcium phosphate if it's not better in 2 to 4 weeks, usually. I have no other questions.
Dr. Alano, do you have any questions for Dr. Saunders?
Sure. Are you talking about calcium stress fractures? I rarely do any surgical intervention on these diseases. If it's a stress fracture, it's usually zero, within 4 to 6 weeks or 8 weeks of immobilization. Is that your experience, Dr. Saunders?
That was unclear to me. I'm sorry, I couldn't understand you well, but I think you're asking conservatively if the patient has a stress fracture, immobilization for, 6 to 8 weeks would be reasonable. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah, I would agree with that from a conservative point of view. I think this patient suffered also from some tarsal tunnel syndrome. I think this patient had some plantar fasciitis. I am uncertain if this patient actually had stress fractures or insufficiency to the calcaneus. And that's really, I think, what comes down to it. Dr. Clark believed the patient to be, and that's how he treated him. It's just some of the actions were not consistent.
Yes, it's also concerning to me that postoperatively they gave him a series of amnio injections within a 2 week period of time frame. So to me that was excessive. Hold on.
Yeah, I believe that there were, in my opinion, too many of the amnio injections, or at least it's not well documented as to the rationale for doing more of the more of the amnio injections. We said it earlier, I believe that there should be a little bit more of a time period before after each injection. I think the usage of the amnio is acceptable. You're doing what you can for the patient. I think that's okay. I think just too many were necessarily done without proper documentation as to why we're doing them.
Yeah, and the documentation that it's improving or helping the patient. I'll listen to the question. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Alano. Dr. Saunders, do you have any other remarks you want to make before we hear from the doctor and his counsel?
I'd make it just a note that, when trying to go through some of the charts, and we've talked about other cases that I'll try not to merge here, it's a little hard to follow. I'd like there to be some more independent thought processes documented in the chart, maybe excludes some of the irrelevant information that was cut and pasted. To a certain extent, we all cut and paste. But we can get rid of or omit some of the pasting that was preoperatively, that we don't need to kind of keep our discussion going because it mutters it and it doesn't have new information for us. And then documentation of postoperative course, especially when we're dealing with and billing at this time for bilateral cases, we should document how the patient's doing postoperatively, rather than talk about your next step. We need to document that a little bit better, I think. But no, that's all I have.
Okay, thanks very much. All right, Mr. Crawford, Dr. Clark. So, Mr. Crawford, I would ask if you would like to speak first.
Yeah, I have a few comments, if that's okay, Dr. Campbell. First off, I think Dr. Clark's tried to respond twice now to Dr. Saunders' comments and concerns. You obviously have that. One thing, just before we even start, to be honest with you, I'm not sure where the confusion here is. I don't think this case has been discussed before. We were scheduled for August, and we were notified the day before, I think, that it was canceled. So we're a little confused if there was some discussion that we didn't know about, we weren't noticed on. I think the board is mistaken, to be honest with you. I think before the August meeting, you continued the actual initial review and it requested more information. So just so, because I got a request for the MRI, and I directed Heather that she needed to subpoena that from Simon Med. So just to clear that up, if you met and discussed this case without us knowing it, it shouldn't happen. And I think you know that. So I think that's a was incorrect when there was those kind of comments. So I'll go beyond that. I mean, obviously, regardless, we've gotten two reports from Dr. Saunders, so we understand his concerns. You know, we've provided various literature to the board, a couple of letters from some doctors who routinely review Dr. Clark's documentation in I'm just going to say real life, so to speak, and who don't have the concerns about it being confusing, etc. Just to be proactive on this thing and let the board know that, you know, Dr. Clark takes this stuff seriously. He voluntarily did some continuing medical education on plantar fasciitis, heel pain, stress fractures, including imaging related to stress fractures. So, I mean, he's tried to be very proactive in terms of dealing with the board's concerns. I think that the other thing that I want to be very upfront about, this patient complainant contacted Dr. Clark without any solicitation back in, I think it was July, and without discussing attorney-client communications too much, specifically the response back to this gentleman was, Dr. Clark cannot discuss any type of resolution of his concerns or whatever until this board matter is done, okay? Because I didn't want any perception that something was done to get this guy to drop his board complaint, okay? So, and I've consistently told doctors that. So that was the situation. Dr. Clark told him, I'm sorry, I can't do anything while the board's resolved. Once the board thing is resolved, if you want to talk, we can talk. Apparently, after that discussion, he sent a letter, the patient, to the board, essentially saying, I don't want to pursue this. That was not a condition of anything. And I want to be that to be very, very clear to the board. That's kind of the lay of the land. Dr. Clark's here to respond to your specific questions. He's tried to address Dr. Saunders' concerns in two different responses. So you have that. And I think probably the best thing to do is to turn it over to Dr. Clark and or you in terms of what questions you may have of him.
Yeah, I think it'd be appropriate if Dr. Clark, if he could just give a summary and then board members can ask questions. We can have an open dialogue on this.
Thank you. The care summary has been pretty well summarized, I feel, with patient presenting with heel pain from his rheumatologist. Had an MRI, which I believe had subtle but had findings of plantar fasciitis and bone marrow edema of his calcaneus. It seems that maybe the biggest question that the board has would be the rationale for this calcium phosphate to be performed when the radiologist failed to note a stress fracture. I think part of the confusion I think arises in that the terminology of stress fracture and bone marrow edema. I remember seeing the MRI report that his radiologist or his rheumatologist had sent over that basically was a copy and paste of a template of a normal ankle MRI. And in the presence of such clinically significant findings of heel pain, I felt that the radiologist may have been looking more at ankle as opposed to the actual heel and plantar fascia. And so when pulling up the images, I was able to scroll through all three planes of the images, and I was able to appreciate both plantar fasciitis and some bone marrow edema where that fascia inserts on the heel bone. on the, you know, there's, I can give the exact image numbers if the board would like to, but I believe that in the clinical setting of having such significant heel pain that it was not responding to injections and icing and stretching and the other non-surgical options, that his best options would be prolonged immobilization or performing this subconjunctivoplasty procedure. The question was raised a lot about immobilization before surgery, and my common practice for a stress fracture or bone marrow edema would be preferentially to immobilize for anywhere from 6 to 8 to even 12 weeks, depending on progress that gets made. The patient was adamant that given his lifestyle, given where he was in life, that he did, that was not going to be a viable option. And at that point, when a patient refuses a non-surgical option, and that's kind of the last non-surgical option, it felt reasonable to offer this subchondroplasty procedure. To just sum up to the issue of did he or did he not have a stress fracture, you know, as I stated, there are various images on all three planes of the MRI that I believe show bone marrow edema of the calcaneus and plantar fasciitis. And to the board, with the article that Dr. Saunders had mentioned, there were other articles that I sent as well that show the sensitivity and specificity of finding stress fractures on MRIs. One of the articles specifically stated that the sensitivity is only about 68%, meaning that if a MRI does not show a stress fracture, there is still a 32% chance, 32% likelihood that person does indeed have a stress fracture. And I sent over an article actually relating specifically to subchondroplasty for the foot and the ankle. And in that article, there were 18 patients that were treated, and only 5 of those patients had bone marrow edema on their MRI. And this is ultimately why. And in school and residency, they teach and they train that we treat people, not images. And I firmly believe that was the case with this patient, that while his images may not have needed the procedure to be done, I believe that the patient did. And that's our duty as doctors, as podiatrists, as surgeons, to do what's best for the patient. So, you know, in the absence of a radiologist agreeing or any other podiatrist agreeing, I believe that given the clinical presentation, given the physical exam, lack of response to non-surgical treatment, I believe that he did have bone marrow edema, which would be treated with this subchondroplasty procedure. As far as, you know, non-weight bearing after surgery, that's one of the reasons that we do the subchondroplasty procedure, is it doesn't require non-weight bearing typically for more than about 2 weeks. That was my experience in my training working with both podiatrists and foot and ankle orthopedic surgeons. A lot of the orthopedics I worked with as well, they do this a lot around the proximal tibia near the knee, and it's the same. They actually don't immobilize at all. They have them range of motion and weight bearing immediately. So I don't believe that non-weight bearing both before surgery or after would have been more appropriate, given this patient's both lack of willingness to do immobilization before surgery, as well as performing this procedure does not typically require such prolonged immobilization after surgery. Regarding the amniotic fluid injections, I appreciate that Dr. Campbell mentioned that Spectra article. I actually used to have students from the podiatry school working with me, and we reviewed that article various times together. This has been kind of a hot topic over the last probably 6 to 10 years in orthopedics and pain management of amniotic fluid injections. And while that article did space the injection, one of the main arguments that the authors make is that the relief may or may not have actually been from the amniotic fluid, that it was probably from the immobilization. And as I would review this article with students, we would have that same conversation. Well, you know, I mean, if you put someone in a boot long enough, chances are high they probably will get better. It's a matter of will the patient consent and be compliant in that immobilization. So in the lack of the patient being willing to immobilize for such an extended period of time, both the subconscious rhinoplasty procedure as well as repeated amniotic fluid injections were a reasonable option given his disinterest and unwillingness to pursue any other options. There were just a couple other things that questions that were asked, but if the board would like to ask me directly anything specifically, I'll take it to that point.
Well, the other study I was thinking of was the Gellhorn study. He's a physiatrist that did the same thing as resolution of the heel pain at 1 month, 2 months, and 3 months with one amnion injection was 68% decrease at 1 month, 82% at 2 months, and 91% at 3 months on 1 month.
Yes,
you had found ever had read that article.
Yes, I'm actually familiar with those as well, and I agree with those articles that if you can also have immobilization and icing and physical therapy and the other non-surgical modalities, I believe that would have a chance of success. My experience both in practice as well as around the community and in my training as a resident not long ago, that these injections tend to have an additive effect. So as you do them, as you repeat them, whether it's 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks apart, they do have that added effect and that compounding effect on each other. And that was the rationale for doing them as soon apart as they were, is trying to get that additive benefit to avoid a repeat procedure needing to be done.
So with each one of those injections, did you do a medical necessity letter? Because I noticed a couple times there was some mention of medical necessity, because that many amnio injections, I can imagine an insurance company might have a little bit of a problem.
Yes, with each injection, each procedure that gets performed, the facility, whatever pain center that they're performed at, they typically request authorization, which normally necessitates a letter of medical necessity. So yes, I believe that there was one done. That's what the insurance requested.
So I have some other questions. So in regards to manipulation of the calcaneus, did you actually feel or see movement when you manipulated that calcaneus when you did the calcium phosphate injection?
So yes, as the subchondroplasty procedure is performed, the needle, using a C-arm, using fluoroscopy, the needle is placed where the bone marrow edema is believed to be located. And then at that time, the incision is spread to be able to visualize the cortex of the bone. And then I grasp each end of the calcaneus and try to kind of wiggle and manipulate that bone just to ensure that the cortex is not violated. If you try to inject this substance into a bone that has a violated cortex, like an OCD, or if they had a cortical fracture, that would extravasate through the cortex and that would cause larger problems. So yes, it was both visualized through the incision as well as on fluoroscopy that there did not appear to be a cortical.
So, and on the second procedure, did you do the same? Was the same technique used?
Yes, it was.
So, because this guy has gout, did you see any evidence anywhere of any kind of gout-related cysts or tophi or anything?
No, you would typically see the tophi and things like that in a joint, which I was not near a joint and didn't feel like he had a problem with the joint. So, no, there was no evidences of gout regarding this case at all.
Well, you can have it at the fascial insertions and tendon insertions, too, but you didn't see anything there.
Correct, right. So the plantar fasciotomy was performed endoscopically, so as that fascia gets severed, if there had been tophi, it would have been visualized through the endoscope, and there was not appreciated.
Now, I know we talked about this a little bit, and you responded to it in your responses about that the patient was evaluated at the surgical center. I still have questions about, here you've got somebody who has a BMI over 37. They have, the chronic inflammation problems of fasciitis, got a stress fracture, we've got gout, which is also an inflammatory process. Why a patient who's having a general didn't have a chest x-ray, unless it's just that's what these surgery centers are doing these days, and no latch, because I still have a concern about a hidden diabetes that can be related to the tarsal tunnel, that can be related to plantar fasciitis. To me, that's not fully analyzing the patient. Now, I don't, you know, we don't have any labs in here from the surgery center or anything that indicates, you know, that was checked out. That's just kind of something that sits with me. When you treat the patient, you treat the whole patient. So just concerned that there wasn't anything in there. Also, I'm wanted to...
Am I able to respond to that?
Yeah, please.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I appreciate the comment and the concern for the patient. I believe at the time he was 36 or 37 in his mid to late 30s. He was being followed by his rheumatologist who, as you're very familiar, they do those labs usually every 3 to 6 months. So I had the benefit at the time, I was still working with the arthritis group, I had the benefit of being able to look in the chart and see those labs. So it's not like this patient was blindly taken to a surgery center. He certainly had labs drawn recently by the rheumatologist. The medical director at the surgery center reviewed the case as well and decided that it was not necessary to perform a chest x-ray or anything else in the absence of symptoms that would have necessitated it. So while I agree that there is a workup that needs to be done on patients, there also is overutilization of certain services that the medical director, who is a board certified medical doctor, agreed that they would have been a waste of resources to perform those for this patient.
But did you document that in the chart that you reviewed those and knew that patient's medical background was, you know, had been noted to be okay to enter surgery?
It is noted in his preoperative history and physical that he was deemed to be an appropriate candidate for a surgery.
But that was done by or was that done by you?
So my preoperative note was by me, and then at the level of the surgery center, there also is notation both from the anesthesiologist as well as the medical director that he was an appropriate candidate for an ASC.
And again, back to musculoskeletal here for a minute, was there any indication that he had any other biomechanical issue like a leg length discrepancy or anything else that could have been part of the podiatric complaint?
Limb length discrepancy was not appreciated and was not commented on. It's not normally something I comment unless there is one.
And I know you did the Z-plasty to prevent, I believe your rationale is to prevent any skin contractures. I think you noted that was something that you tended to see in other cases. So, but the patient never had a keloid or any problems like that it would have been done to prevent or in response to?
You're asking if he had previously had keloids?
Right, and was that another rationale for the Z-plasty and the tarsal tunnel?
Good question. No, I don't believe he had previously had any surgeries that he had noted a history of keloid. It's more for, and Dr. Saunders actually raised a question too that we had responded to about performing these procedures through the same incision. And when you perform an endoscopic plantar fasciotomy and endoscopic tarsal tunnel through that small incision, due to the dissection that you have to do in two different directions from that incision, they do have a tendency to form a painful scar. And so that's why the incision, it didn't need to be extended to the length that an open procedure would have been. So there was still definitely the indication for to do it endoscopically. But I do like to perform a small Z-plasty of that incision because it is more likely than not to form a keloid due to the dissection that has to occur to do both of those procedures through that incision.
And, okay, this is about the low nerve fiber density result from the biopsies. So because of that low density, did you consider at that time did anything come to mind again about possibility of diabetes or anything?
So all of his laboratory work, I never had a glucose higher than 126 milligrams per deciliter. So, no, at that time, it still wasn't a thought process that diabetes would be a factor.
Yeah. You know, we've seen a lot of the patients that you have that have had a lot of the same types of procedures like the, you know, endoscopic gastroc recession, tarsal tunnel fasciotomy, and the injections for the calcaneal stress fracture. Are a lot of these patients referred to you for this problem? Is this like becoming a subspecialty for you? Because it seems like you have a lot of the same type of cases.
That's a good question. Yes, because in my training I learned the endoscopic methods of performing these procedures. Most of the time they are very successful, and not only do referring providers who refer to me see the success and keep referring those types of patients to me, but these patients have friends, family, and acquaintances with similar symptoms that they refer to me as well. So it is a procedure that I perform a lot of because I see a lot of it, mostly from referrals from people that have had a good experience with the procedure.
The patient opined that you told him that he needed surgery right away. I just would like a comment on that.
I mean, I completely disagree, and my notes would also disagree with that. That there was a variety of non-surgical options presented and offered, and again, just in the, with the clinical symptoms and what I believe to be the bone marrow edema on his MRI, I let him know that surgery was an option, but it is not my common practice, unless it's a very severe comminuted fracture, to indicate that someone would need surgery without attempting a wider range, wide variety of non-surgical options. I don't believe that was accurate.
And during the time that you were using the amniotic injections, the patient was not receiving any non-steroidals or any cortisone, correct?
That is correct.
Go ahead. Why do you think this case didn't work? Why do you think this case needed to go 3 months or 2 months later, or maybe 2 to 3 months later, that you needed to do those amniotic injections? Why do you think it failed? You did a plantar fasciotomy, you did a tarsal tunnel, you did this bone marrow injection. Why do you think it failed and you needed to go on to amniotic injections and to a second calcium phosphate injection?
That's a good question. And this goes back to training in residency and other pain management doctors I know around the community that doing amniotic fluid injections within the first few months after surgery will reduce the scarring, reduce the fibrosis that develops from surgery. And so initially, actually, as you scan through the postoperative notes, initially his heel actually was doing pretty well. It wasn't until about 6 weeks after performing the fasciotomy that he started to notice it kind of going bad again. And so the amniotic fluid injections a lot of times after surgery can help reduce that fibrosis that occurs from surgery and ensure a both better and longer lasting outcome from surgery. So a few of them were actually performed, you could say prophylactically to help prevent the fibrosis and help prevent those complications from surgery that would normally develop.
And I have another question. When you talk about the radiologist missing or not appreciating a stress fracture or bone marrow edema, do you ever ask for a second read and find a radiologist who is proficient in reading musculoskeletal exams?
Yes, I often do that. I didn't get a formal on this patient, but it is my practice that when they send over a copied and pasted normal exam that I don't feel is normal, I will oftentimes call the radiology facility and request a second.
Do you ever request they do a follow-up or reevaluate at that time because of your questions and concern?
I'm sorry, follow up with who?
With the radiologist, after you've spoken with them on the phone, do you have a say, hey, this is what I'm seeing, this is my patient's clinical picture, and are you thinking about this clinical picture when the radiologist giving you their best?
I mean, usually it just takes one conversation where I say, hey, I believe that given the clinical picture, I'm seeing this, and a lot of times they will make an addendum to their note. Correct.
I see this all the time in the cases that I defend, and the truth of the matter is, in my experience, there aren't that many radiologists that have the musculoskeletal, and they miss things in foot and ankle issues all the time, and typically the doctor, the podiatrist, the surgeon, relies on their interpretation in the context of their clinical setting. So, I mean, in addition, obviously we always see clinical correlation required, So all I can tell you is, and the experts that I've retained over the years who've talked about this basically say, this is not unusual for radiologists to not appreciate things that we see, especially when we have the clinical indications. So
I agree. That's why I'm asking the questions.
I don't typically see podiatrists asking for second opinions from radiologists and things like that. Not typically. Sure, in a very unusual case, I don't disagree. But typically, they rely on their own evaluation of the MRI plus the clinical indications and setting.
Well, very complete, Dr. Campbell. The one question I have, why don't you document the patient did not want to wear a boot?
I don't know.
Okay.
That I believe that his notes offered immobilization as an option, but I believe that I failed to document that he refused.
Because I mean that would half the case would be, you know, I didn't know that based upon the notes. So that's why, I mean, you said you tried to give him a boot and he didn't want to wear it. I mean, that's on the patient then. That was one thing I had.
Dr. Ilano, do you have any questions for Dr. Clark?
No, I've heard enough. I've got a good grasp and idea of what's going on with the case.
Okay, thank you. All righty. Well, you know, we can go back and forth, I think, all day about, you know, especially with sensitivity of different radiology techniques, you know, from our MRIs to things as what's not apparent on an MRI, how many times you don't see a stress fracture, et cetera, what's appreciated and what is not, and how do you determine which little category that patient fell into. I think I'm still hearing the main concerns, again, are the not documenting, like the patient's refusal of the CAM boot, because that, again, like Dr. Foreman indicated, would make, you know, a big difference here in how this was, you know, thought about. And Dr. Saunders gave several other examples here, too, about, you know, having the post or the pre-op template still present post-operatively, and that does get confusing. I mean, I know you have the notes for, or letters from outside physicians that said, oh, we have no problem, but, you know, you probably are talking with them on the telephone and clearing things up. This is not happening in this situation when somebody's picking up a chart and they can't follow it, because it does lose flow, and when you don't see somebody's thought process, you know, saying a little bit more does help in that response, or in seeing what's going on, and not having, you know, when you have a new data service, you have to have something different. You know, you've got to explain what you're seeing. You don't, you know, and I think, again, reiterated by Dr. Saunders. And you agreed with that the standard of care for, you know, immobilizing a stress fracture, but then we didn't know that the patient had refused the CAM boot. I think, you know, there would be question too. I still feel there are questions and concerns about the amount of the amniotic injections that were given and, you know, post-operative or the post-injection lack of immobilization. You know, everybody's thought here on how they use the calcium phosphate, but do, you know, immobilize a lot longer before that. Again, we go back to the story of we didn't know that the patient refused. And Dr. Saunders, you know, main question again, was there really a stress fracture? And again, we go back to the discussion of don't treat the patient, or you treat the patient, not the x-rays, and what is the sensitivity of various radiographic imaging to determine if there really is one present. Anything else? where you think we're going here?
Well, my suggestion would be to actually, if you're using the templates, just take off the pre-op the following visit, with the next visit, and just put down, you know, make even a medical assistant can write, you know, patient did not want to wear a cam walker boot. Part of it is patient compliance also in, you know, any of these cases, because it's an important fact. If they're not doing what you tell them to do and your recommendations, to me, it's on them, not on you.
Well, and another thing, that the page has said that they asked for records, which they did get their records, but there was no evidence in the chart of a signed release form, because you're supposed to, you know, always have a medical records release form in the chart, and there was no, to correct Dr. Saunders,
yeah,
that there was no...
I don't believe there was a signed release form. I believe that the patient was communicating via email with Dr. Clark's office manager at one point or another for the records, when he was asking for them. I think it was done twice. I think the patient did get them the second time for sure. But I did not see a signed release form, and, you know, there are times that patients will just tell you in person they want records. There are times that patients will call up and do it. It's sometimes hard to track, so I think I try in my own practice. It's not always 100% successful, but I try to always get a signed release form, even when they're right there in front of me. Just sign the form. Then you have a date of when they requested the record, and then obviously when you respond.
Do you have that in your documentation file, when in your patient's intake, for, you know, when they do their initial paperwork with you, that they sign, have a release in there that they sign? And then if you need specific stuff from another physician, that you have another one where you put the dates and what you want?
It's part of our intake forms, and I know that, and apparently maybe it was after this gentleman, or maybe because he requested them in an unconventional fashion, but I do know that when patients request, we do have them sign a form, so I don't know exactly what happened in this case, but I know it is our practice to always have them sign a release request on the day they request them.
To interject again, there is documentation that the patient requested the records, so I've been down this road as well, where they don't sign a release, or they won't, and then when the doctor doesn't release the records because of that, we get a board complaint. Kind of, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. You try to get the release, the written release, you rest, but if you've got documented requests by the patient for the records and you don't release them, now you potentially are going to be before the board on failing to refuse to provide the records. And I've been here in those exact cases, so. And I, were you still with AARA at the time?
We started with AARA in this case, yeah.
So, I mean, is it, to my board members here, to determine has documentation or any of these issues that we've talked about today, are they below community standard of care versus what you might consider best practice?
I do not think they fell below community. The only part is the documentation that the patient did not want to wear a cam walker. But the rest of the notes, I mean, we all copy and paste and we all bring over the last note, and we're all busy in our practices, and the EHRs are a godsend and a curse at the same time. But the documentation to me was the only thing missing was that the patient declined to wear a cam walker boot, in my opinion.
And Dr. Campbell, based on the conversation and the fact that the board has offered a probationary agreement in another case for record keeping, you know, the board could choose to dismiss or file a letter of concern for the issues denoted in here if you were looking at non-disciplinary action. Just throwing that out there.
And because the same, what I said, that we have the other the possibility is if we felt there were anything going here that we needed to combine to another case, is that appropriate?
If you didn't feel that previous case would be the issue,
well, I think they would. I think that they will. What's already on the docket there is appropriate. So then I would then just offer, I'll make a motion to offer a letter of concern just regarding, again, issues of the documentation issues that we discussed, like especially about the patient. There was no notation of the refusal or the treatment.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you, Dr. Lano. So moved.
Thank you.
Dr. Farahani, thank you for your patience. Thank you, Dr. Saunders.
Have a
good Christmas. Yes. I was kind of trying to... So Dr. Farahani, good morning. Bye-bye. Complaint number 2215-C, Shyla. How do you say her name? Do you know?
I believe it's Shyla Arya.
Arya. Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Arya is present today. I apologize.
Yeah.
I did not want to.
Wait.
I did not want to butcher your name. So we're going to go ahead here, Doctor, and we're going to have Dr. Farahani give his report, and then I will ask you for comments. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks. Dr. Farahani, please.
Hi, good morning, everybody. This is regarding the investigation report complaint number 22-15-C. Licensee is Dr. Shyla Arya, license number POD000940. I'm Dr. Farahani. This was dated to 10-23-2022. This is a summary of allegation. EC states that on 1-12-2022, patient was charged a deductible on his visit for an amount of $123.24, even though he had informed the doctor's office that the patient did not have a copay. He was told that it would be refunded a check or refunded back. EC claims that at the time of filing this complaint, he had waited 7 months with no refund in place. He demanded a $123.24 to be refunded back to him at the date fixed for the complaint on 8-8-2022. He further states that the office discussed that they do not accept his insurance. He finds this to be unethical and wrong. There was a letter attached by Dr. Arya. Madam President, do you want me to read this, or have you guys already gone through?
Gone through all that. Yeah, you don't need to belabor.
Redundancy, I'm not going to. The letter was attached. Here's my review in terms of medical records. On 8-21-2021, diabetic foot care / nail issue, there was a second opinion on a nail avulsion by another provider. And then on 9-3-2021, there was a diabetic foot checkup. On 11-12-2021, there was a diabetic foot checkup. 12-17-2021, there was a new complaint, foot swelling, there was x-rays, DME, dispensing a post-op shoe. And then 12-29-2021, there was a pain in the right foot, recurrence of third met fracture on x-ray. The appropriate as there's a lag for fractures on x-ray since 12-17 of 2021. There was an x-ray and then they dispensed DME / CAMBOOT. And then on 1-12-2022, there was a follow-up. I reviewed the financials that Dr. Arya provided. They were somewhat very detailed. The billing, I'm going to go from the dates of service. 8-21-2021, there was a 99203. The member responsibility was 2208. The insurance had paid $88.34. On 9-3 of 2021, there was a 99213. There was a member responsibility, which is a copay of $40, and insurance paid $49.83. 11-12-2021, 99213, member responsibility, $40 copay. The insurance had paid $49.83. On 12-17-2021, there was a new complaint, so it was a 99213, size 736-30LT, which stands for left foot. Member responsibility was $55. $40 of that was the copay, and the $15 of that was the copay for the x-ray. The insurance had paid $68.24. On 12-29-2021, there was a 99214. There was another x-ray of 736-30 left foot. There was dispensing of a Camwood, which is L3461. The member responsible was $55. The $40 copay and a $15 x-ray copay. And the insurance had paid $348. On 1-12 of 2022, there was a CPT code of 99213-73630. There was a member responsibility of $70, and the insurance had paid $53.54. Total owed in terms of patient's responsibility, when I calculated, was $282.08. Total charge, $25 for post-op shoe, assuming that would be credited for the patient as the provider signed to run through insurance. There was $123.24 was collected from the patient, and there was a leaves an outstanding balance of $158.84 that remains due to the provider currently. So here's my conclusion. I do not believe that these allegations were that the complaint provider are substantiated. EC's understanding of his benefits is inaccurate. Reviewing the billing in detail, I believe the billing was done precisely as appropriate within the paradigm of billing for care provided. I actually made it a point to call the insurance carrier to try to verify everything. There was indeed a $40 office visit copay, $15 per x-ray copay. There will also increase the copay amount from $40 to $70 within the new year 2022. Since I've done this multiple times in your presence, this is a great case in point for patients to verify their coverage and perform their own due diligence, because there's only so much a provider can do. The patient continued to contest the charge that should have been payable to the provider's office from the get-go and set forth by his complaint. The patient has a responsibility to clearly do his own due diligence, not just this patient, but any patient, and abide by the member responsibility that they sign, as much as a provider is to provide care as per terms of their provider contract with the insurance company, which in case was strictly handled very well by this particular provider and their office and their staff and the billing department. Then, based on my detailed review, a total of $282.08 was due to the provider. The contested amount was $123.24 by the patient, which only covered the balance due. And the patient, based on my calculations and calling ratio, the patient currently actually has a balance due to the provider for an additional $158.84. So, that's my take. I realize that Dr. Arya is a new practitioner. So it wasn't too long ago that I've gone through my hurdles in practice. I personally think that she carried this in a very, very professional manner. She was very respectful, and I have never met her, but from the tone of her letter, I realize, she's just probably, if she did make any mistakes, she's learning. But she didn't make any mistakes through my review. So I wish her all the best, and that's pretty much it.
Thank you for that report. I am in total agreement with you, and I have no questions. Dr. Foreman, any questions? Dr. Ilano, any questions?
That was very thorough, Dr. Faharani, and I enjoyed that. Thank you. No question.
Thanks. All right. So, Dr. Arya, if you would like to make a remark, please.
Thank you so much for taking the time to review it. As you mentioned, I am a new provider, and getting subpoenaed by the board was really scary for me. I didn't actually, to be quite honest, I actually never really had any, issues like this come up before. And the billing and stuff and being in small practices is for me, so I really appreciate the time it took to review my case. I do have one question about how to handle the situation with the patient with me. I don't think he's completely stable. He, calls the office repeatedly telling me he's going to sue me for the $124. And so I don't really know, I know that the board is limited in what they do, but I don't know if anybody has any recommendations of how we should handle the situation with the patient.
As a board, we're not an advisory board, we're a regulatory board. So, but if you feel threatened in any way by this person, you can always contact local law authorities, like DPS.
Okay.
Yeah. And keep a well-documented doctor,
okay.
If you have issues like
that.
Okay.
We'll do that. I really appreciate your time and including me in this.
And also, you can always, a lot of times malpractice carriers will offer coursework in teaching you how to deal with those kind of patients, and that's a good way to educate yourself.
But also, you're always more than welcome to, I know this is outside of the sports jurisdiction. I call my colleagues, get their opinions on certain things. Obviously the board can't give you those discretionary advices, but if you ever need any help, I'd be more than happy to help you out any way that I can.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you so much.
All right. Then I am going to go ahead and make a motion to dismiss case 22-15-C, seeing no violations of state statutes.
Seconded.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. All right. Thank you all so much. Okay. Let's go back to the beginning and do our minutes. We have the November 9th, 2022 general session minutes. I did note some additional notation that I'd like to see in the, hang on a second, added to that. I've got so much paper here, hang on a second. I'll find where to put that. It had to do on the discussion about the consent agreement for Dr. Clark. It just needed to be noted in there that it was going to be, the attorneys were going to be discussing the...
That's the old case.
Right, on the old case, right. Where did I put my notes? I'm sorry. Like I said, there's just too much stuff here for me to find. It was just noting, too, that consent agreement from the minutes, that it was going to come back to the board for a vote.
Madam Chair, board members, if I may, I do have the draft minutes pulled up, and I did make corrections.
Oh, you did do the corrections.
So I can go ahead and read that, if that's okay.
That would be really wonderful.
So Dr. Campbell made a motion seconded by Dr. Foreman to direct the board's assistant attorney general to negotiate a consent agreement with Dr. Clark and his attorney. The consent agreement shall include, but is not limited to, 1 year probation and quarterly chart audits. Dr. Clark shall submit 10 chart audits during the 1 year probation. So that was the correction I made based on our conversation.
Okay, so thank you so much. So does anybody have any other concerns or questions with those minutes, the general session ones? Okay. Hearing none, then I will make a motion to accept the general session minutes from our last meeting, which is November 9, 2022, with corrections made.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Okay, our next minutes would be from executive session of first executive session from November 9th. That's timestamp from 9:28 a.m. to 9:38 a.m. Does anybody have any additions or corrections? Okay, hearing none, I will make a motion to accept executive session minutes from 9:28 to 9:38 a.m. as written.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. And then we have November 9, 2022, executive session minutes from 9:23 a.m. to 10:31 a.m. Does anyone have any concerns or questions regarding those minutes? All right. Hearing none, I will make a motion to accept November 9, 2022, executive session minutes from 9:23 a.m. to 10:31 a.m. as written.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. All right. Then, if everybody's okay with moving on here, with, if anybody wants a break, speak now or forever hold your peace. Okay, so let's go on to 5B, which is the issuances of licenses. We have two license applications. The first is from Dr. Jamanelli Banks, and Dr. Banks' application is via examination, which is just, you know, standard application. Does anyone have any questions or concerns regarding her application? It is complete and fees have been paid, correct, Heather?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and make a motion to accept Dr. Jamanelli Banks' application for initial licensure and as it is statutorily complete.
So
thank you, Dr. Thurman. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 And also, I forgot to add into that that's a license upon payment of the issuance fee. I'm sorry, I forgot to
say. Okay.
Thank you. All right. Well, then our second application is Joshua Modlin, and this is via comedy. And I believe everything is statutorily complete. Is there any questions or concerns regarding this application from Dr. Modlin? Okay. Hearing none, I will go ahead and make a motion to accept Dr. Modlin's application for licensure via comedy and to dispense a license upon payment of the issuance fee.
Seconded.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. All right, we've had our discussion with Mr. Abadi. So, Executive Director's Report.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Board Members. This is a brief update. I provided a copy of the current budget. I can answer any questions on that. And I also provided a copy of the complaint log. I've received two new complaints, one yesterday afternoon, one this morning through the e-licensing portal that will be added. Otherwise, there's been no changes, and I can answer any questions on that. And that's my summary.
Thank you.
Oh, no, and when does the 2023 legislation be, when does that ledge period begin?
It's the second or third week of January.
Yeah.
We'll begin, so I'll have the first update for the board in, at its February meeting.
Yeah. Okay. All righty. Okay, and are there any current events that we need to summarize or anything there on that topic? Nope. All righty. And the public is, we have no public to call. And does anybody for 10 have any items they'd like to see on future meeting agendas? Okay. I'm hearing none then. Our next board meeting is January 11th, 2023. And we're going to do 8 a.m. Is that still?
Fine with
8 a.m. Okay, then we're going to keep it at 8 a.m.
I'll go earlier.
No. That's...
I'm at the gym at 5, so.
All righty, so at 9:24 a.m., I am going to make a motion. Seeing that all, if there's anything else, anybody have any other remarks? Okay. Seeing that all agenda items have been dealt with, I am going to make a motion to adjourn at 9:24 a.m. on December the 14th, 2022.
Second it.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Yay.
Thank you.
Is that what our docket is?